I think it's worth sort of digging into, like, are these synergies real?
Look, this deal, it might just cement Parenti in as the preferred miner for the occasional, you know, job that DDH would have otherwise won from a drilling perspective, from cradle to graveyard.
Yeah, I'm interested to know if that actually plays or not, because they still, even though Parenti own them all, they'll still have a DDH1 shirt on. It's still all divided up into subsidiaries. Like, it's still Barminco doing the underground mining in Australia. It's still Swick doing the underground diamond drilling. They're just owned by DDH1. It's like the only synergies are up really, really high. Here's a play. This would make sense if they buy mines as well. G'day, Money Waters. 26th of June. Dad is back. Left the children for a week. Boys, sensational job last week. Without me, New Year's could do it.
We struggled, mate. We were really stretching the barrel trying to come up with jokes.
Old knee slappers. Don't worry, there was a cut. I seen JD on the first day trying to coordinate a bit of comedy into the event. I was very proud.
We tried our best with comedy. Did you notice JD's pacing? He's like, all right, move on to this. But normally you'd ask about 4 to 5 follow-up questions.
Yes. No, good stuff. JD's dialing in from Melbourne, where I was. JD, how are you, Cobber?
I'm doing well, mate. How was the BD trip last week?
Oh, no, it wasn't bad.
Keen to hear a bit.
Oh, well, I was pretty mature on the last night because the body was starting to say a bit of no, especially after my abysmal State of Origin performance. But I met a lot of new people, met some absolute GCs over there. Met Nick Kelso, who does Rats Rant. He is an absolute ripper of a dude. He met the guys at Terra Capital, Matty Langsford, and who else I met? Robbie Joseph from Bell Potter. He's a bloody ripping character as well. But a lot of people didn't know about us. You wouldn't believe it. I thought the whole country knew about us, but we should be making some inroads into the mining media industry after a little East Coast roadshow.
Yeah, maybe we've got to get on the road ourselves.
Oh, mate, you've got to do it. Yeah. Sydney's where all the moolah is.
Well, I think the three of us jump in a bus and just, you know, travel around Australia. What do you reckon?
Well, I reckon just bloody, bugger that, Qantas Lounge. We haven't got time to drive, buddy.
I was going to say, I love it. The bus is an interesting take, but some road tripping nevertheless sounds pretty good.
I reckon we do some events over east. Why not?
Take the potty
on
tour.
It's all on the cards, hey?
Yeah. Right, let's get into it, boys. So, okay, deep dive later on today is going to be into the Parenti takeover of DDH1, a bit of consolidation in the mining services space. So this is a pretty interesting one. And look, we've got plenty of other news. We've got Musgrave's response to Westgold. That's finally arrived. We've got our Wyloo. They're on a bit of a campaign to get the Mincor takeover wrapped up. We've also got Calidus closing in on some ounces to maybe help feed their mill. Capricorn close out part of their hedge book. And I reckon you boys will provide a bit of a little finance 101 insight onto this hedge book strategy. And Northern Star have bought some ounces next door to Jundee. Paid up a bit of dosh. Did they pay too much? Too little? Who knows? Boys. Oh, good to be back. Oh, bloody, I missed this in my misery in my hotel room over east. I now have contact with the world. Right, let's get into it. Musgrave recommend shareholders to reject the Westgold offer. So
now, I'll just start, guys. I'll listen back to the take you guys did with Musgrave and Westgold, and I think you hit the nail on the head. So I'm sure Trev will bring up some of the points that you guys made on that chat, but a lot of them are what the Musgrave board and management were sort of echoing today.
Thanks, mate. It's always
specifically echoing what we said. We're in the footnotes.
Yeah, we did, mate. We had our first explicit appearance in an ASX announcement.
First of many.
Well, I'm sure Silver Lake would have liked to put us on an ASX announcement, but it just wasn't allowed to go on ASX. but here we are. We find ourselves tied up in a deal again, which is great. What an achievement for us. It's always nice to pat ourselves on the back, isn't it, JD?
Sure is.
I think this was what we anticipated. It was as you said, first offer, it's probably not going to get accepted. It'd be weird if it did. Trav picked it, and as I said, I'll read out the little quote that we got footnoted with, then you can go into the analysis of it. But in the Musgrave announcement, they said, really, in quotation marks, really straightforward for us. It's just substituting low-grade surface stocks that we've been processed for shallow, high-grade open pit feed. I mean, we've got two processing plants within, one within 40 kilometres and one within 120 kilometres of the Cue Gold project. So that's paraphrasing what Westgold MD Wayne Bramrell said. And if you follow the footnote 12, it's from the Money of Mine podcast.
Love it, mate.
From when we had Wayne on. So, boys, let's get into it. What's going on?
Well, mate, yeah, the Musgrave Board, they've come out with their decision. They've decided to recommend that shareholders reject the Westgold offer. So, yeah, no surprise to us. What they've really like honed in on in their language to shareholders is, I think, the relative value proposition to Musgrave shareholders. And that's basically just based on the fact that Musgrave shares are now trading at a higher price, close to about, you know, 30 cents per share, which is greater than the implied value that they'd receive if they accepted the offer from Westgold, which has sort of traded a bit lower since coming public with the offer. So they're just honing in on that. And what you're seeing in the Musgrave price is it's basically just the market's pricing in a value uplift already, hence that that price differential there, and it's also potentially pricing in the probability of an interloper to come in with a higher offer as well. Either way, Musgrave's board have sort of told shareholders to wait for that uplift, and we're going to recommend reject. So, I thought there were some interesting takeaways from the language in this recommended rejection, and keen to talk about them with you, Matty.
Right. So, and language we're talking about the. Specifically about the potential interlopers, because they were comparing themselves to Ramelius, weren't they?
Yeah.
And that and that's from where we sat as one of the more logical people that are going to be a potential competitor for this deal.
I'll get to that, mate. I reckon, Westgold have something interesting there in their own announcement today. But, you know, keeping with Musgrave, I thought it was interesting that in their recommended rejection, they haven't actually disputed the undisturbed share price, which we thought could be a point of contention. Keep in mind, Westgold made the unsolicited offer off the back of what they perceived as unusual trading behaviour, and their suspicion was that there had been a leak.
I really like that. I think that goes to show that the team at Musgrave are still open to doing a potential deal. Is that how you guys kind of read that as well?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, mate. I mean, if they came out here and there was a bit of language around actually disputing what the undisturbed share price is, then it just makes it a lot harder, I think, for the parties to come together and agree to a logical outcome here, because you just get bogged down in a he said, she said kind of debate instead. So it's positive, I think, on the ability to still get a deal done. That's how I see it.
I think everything seems very positive, Buck, because remember we've come out of one of the more weirder and different M&A transactions in the Genesis and St Barbara and Silver Lake saga, whereas anything here seems extremely friendly compared to that. where it doesn't take much to make us look at the positives at the moment.
That's true, yeah. And you mentioned, JD, that you listened back to the last episode. I think one thing that Matty and I talked about was that the board, they will reject it and they'll point to two things as the basis of rejection on a value perspective, one being the value highlighted in the pre-feasibility study and the second one being the value highlighted by the brokers that actually cover Musgrave. Musgrave board have mentioned both of those in the very first page of their discussion today. I mean, Musgrave, they actually use the explicit language, value of Musgrave demonstrated by analyst commentary post offer. They don't actually say, you know, what they don't mention which analysts cover them or what value they use or how they even value it. But I thought that was an interesting thing to include there, especially because, they might want to stay vague on that one, since Wayne alluded to there being an error in the broker report, which had the highest target price for Musgrave on the show. In that specific instance, the analyst that covers them includes future equity in the sum of the parts valuation of Musgrave, which you can't do.
Right, next, coming up next, boys, Trav, you predicted previously that there would probably have to be a bit of a cash component topped up on what the scrip component is. JD, you've had a listen to our thing. I guess both of you, where do you see this going next? Will there need to be a cash kicker? It would be more script, or will there be another interloper?
I think cash wouldn't hurt, but I think the logical next sort of option we would see would be an increase in price as opposed to just a changing of the structure to start with. Trav, you dug a bit deeper on that, and this is sort of putting Romelius to a side for a moment.
Yeah, I think I think if Westgold come out with a cash kicker, you know X cents per share or whatever as a cash kicker, I think that would be seen as a lot more favourable than just improving the merge ratio. You know, cash is king, right?
So, but what's better for Westgold? Is it better for Westgold to give away their scrip or cash?
I mean, they want to use their scrip right now because their scrip is re-rated, and it's sort of, you know, they've benefited from this re-rating because they've proven that they can actually improve their cash balance over time. So now that they've re-rated their scrip, they're wanting to use that scrip. The reality is they do have a good amount of cash behind them as well. I think they want to deploy that cash in the ground in order to reap the benefits down the track, but they certainly do have capacity to direct some of that cash.
But then wouldn't the cash be better for the cash is only better for Musgrave if they don't believe in the long term value of the Westgold scrip? Would that be right? Fair in saying?
I think it's a fair statement that you would just prefer cash instead of scrip. I mean, that's just a logical thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you give the shareholders the ability to allocate that however they want, right? As opposed to have to, you know, continue being exposed to gold if they don't want to be exposed to gold. You know, who knows, right? The other thing I think we should be cognizant of right now, especially because this offer is denominated in Westgold scrip, is the marketing campaign that Westgold are going to, you know, endure here by virtue of the fact that they're on a bit of a pitch to tell Musgrave shareholders that they're a great company and you should want our scrip, right? And they actually put out an investor presentation themselves today, sort of along the lines of that. It was the cleanest investor presentation I've sort of ever seen out from Westgold. Back in the day when I think Cookie was putting together those presentations, they're a bit more rough and dirty, but this one looked very, very clean, fellas. I'm not sure if you had a chance to take a look at it yourselves, but there were definitely three slides that absolutely stood out to me and grabbed my attention.
First, I think what you're going to hone in on is exactly what stood out. Just skimming through the announcement, they really want to show how valuable their scrip, their stock is, don't they?
Big time, mate. So slide 13, there's a slide there showing their three processing facilities side by side there. The read through to me, see, look at our mills. They're ready to go. We can use these to process the Musgrave ore instead of building a new mill.
Fortnum's definitely not side by side. It's a bloody couple hundred k's away.
Side by side on the page. Yeah. But yeah, they're different location for sure. Slide 19. They basically show all of their mining fleet. They title it Modern Mining Fleet, $200 million replacement value. And you can actually see on the chart there, the graphs, that they actually break apart the proportion of their current fleet that is idle right now. And the read through there is, we can deploy these on Musgrave and there are real synergies that can be leveraged. That's how I interpret that slide.
I reckon, is that the voice they're saying it into? I hope it is. I hope when they're typing that up, they're putting that bloody bit on top as well.
This is my voice.
That's brilliant. I love it, yeah. Trav.
Slide 25, I thought, was the most curious of them all, right? It's a peer benchmarking slide. They've charted themselves, Westgold versus peers, and they've benchmarked it on an EV per resource ounce metric. And you can see Westgold down there at the bottom versus peers. So the
reserve or resource?
Per reserve ounce. Reserve ounce. So, I mean, their argument is that they're undervalued compared to their peers. And when you look at which companies at the very top of that chart there, what do you see? Romelius at the top there. So they're already... You can kind of get a glimpse of what the narrative is going to be here if Romelius come into the picture. They're readying themselves for a potential counteroffer from Romelius, I think, and you can see the line of argument they're going to take. They're going to say, we're cheap, Romelius isn't. Look at their reserve life. There's not much left.
You guys touched on this in the last chat you had about it, and I think you guys got to the point really clearly, you know. not all ounces are the same. You got to look at what the costs are and what the future profitability of the business is, as opposed to just the ounces in the ground, hey?
Yeah, mate. Yeah, I think the point that Ramelius does have, you know, a short reserves life, that's a valid point to make. But, I mean, these are cash-producing businesses. I think we can be a bit more financially astute to use a bit better metrics when sort of comparing these companies instead of an EV per reserve ounce, because ounces are different. Let's look at price to NAV ratio. Let's look at price to cash flow. Let's look at EV to EBITDA. I'm sure Musgrave, Ramelius and Westgold will all internally know those numbers.
So this marketing campaign, do you think is a bit of a, we're titling it a marketing campaign, but this presentation is to really, as you said, pump up what the value that they will perceive, Musgrave shareholders will perceive the Westgold script to be, and would that then possibly lead you to think that maybe they're only going to offer more script in the next offer?
I don't know. They might do, but yeah, they've got cash. I actually think they'll be better served if they include cash in the next offer. They might wait a while as well, right? Because
until there's another
party
involved, like they wouldn't need to really take the risk to put extra cash on, would they?
Yeah, they can play the long game here if they want to. Yeah, I find it interesting. They are definitely trying to sell themselves as a company as being A, undervalued, and B, an attractive company for the long run. And that's what this presentation says to me.
And we look forward to getting Musgrave on soon. We did reach
out. Let's do it.
We did reach out and they said not at this moment.
Yeah,
but look, Musgrave, Worry, happy to have you on whenever, mate. You might just have to push Wayne out of the road because he might come on first again. So
we appreciate the acknowledgement in the announcement today, Musgrave. So yeah, we'd love to host you on our podcast.
Get in touch whenever you want to come on, Group. Right, let's go on. Next up, boys, Wailoo, Mincor. So another bit of a campaign trying to wrap up this takeover, because essentially all the remaining small amount of shares, so they're just over
80%. Now. Yeah.
They need 90% to hit the trigger for compulsory acquisition for Mincor.
Right. Yeah.
But with a lot of these shares held up in either, could be bloody accounts that people don't have access to. A lot are probably in index funds and things like that, and the funds aren't getting rid of them and they're hard to contact. So they're in a bit of a pickle, which would put them, and as you point out here, Trav, put them in a very similar situation to what Genesis ended up with Dacian.
Yeah.
So they didn't get to that 90% compulsory acquisition target. Now it's left in a bit of a inconvenient, semi-confusing situation.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think the key detail is that next Wednesday, 5th of July, is when they had announced that their bid is good till, right?
Yeah, mate. It ends.
That's why they're on that push at the moment.
It ends on the 5th of July. So there's just over a week left, and they need another 10% of shareholders before it can hit that compulsory acquisition switch.
So is there a chance come after June 30, when at the end of the month, that possibly a lot of these indexes might actually start selling these shares because of the takeover thing? Is it a time-dependent thing possibly?
Look, I must admit, Matty, I'm not completely understanding of what the internal decisions are of if there are index funds holding out.
Haven't you seen what I do, Trav? You got to just claim these ideas as your own and just go full noise with it, mate. You've got your own podcast. Just bloody put yourself out there.
I don't think the passives are totally transparent about how they always act in these situations. So it's not super straightforward to say whether they're going to wait until the last day just to vote with the management or whatever. I mean, there's always the possibility that Wailoo would extend again. They can't.
It's the last extension. They can't extend any longer. And they also can't increase their price, right? Because they're best and final. So this is crunch time. And that's why it's interesting. They put out an announcement today basically saying, advertising these exact facts, these parameters. And they're on a bit of a campaign. We've seen some screenshots on Twitter pop up of Wailoo emailing the remaining shareholders. There's also some screenshots of text messages that the remaining shareholders are getting to encourage them to accept. So they're pulling out all stops here to get the remaining holding out hold out shareholders to accept into the offer.
Have they got a hotline, Trav?
Oh, they might too. I'm not sure. We might. Maybe we should bid for some shares at $1.41 on market, and then call the hotline as being core shareholders. That'd be pretty funny, wouldn't it?
Hopefully they need to get the Irish fella back. Yeah. That was Brendan. On the Silver Lake. Shout out to Brendan, yeah. Mate. What a bloody legend. I liked him. The one on the St. Barbara side didn't fill me with too much confidence, but loved the Silver Lake hotline. What happens if they don't get to 90%, and can they then just wait for the vote to give them the power of it?
There's no vote.
So they'll be left in the same spot that Genesis are left in with Dacian.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you kind of have to treat it as an independent company at arm's length, and it keeps its own board and et cetera. So it's just a bit of a pain in the butt. But
what if they then get the shares off them after that date?
I mean, what Mincor is basically threatening to do to the remaining shareholders is delisting Mincor. Those remaining shareholders have to be comfortable having no liquidity. So that they might, they might then, I suppose, I don't know if they're then open to the potential of actually, selling their shares to Mincor down the track. But for the purposes, basically Wailu is threatening to remove the liquidity element that comes with being a listed ASX stock.
Right. Wait to July 5th. Stay tuned, everyone. Right, Calidus. Now, they've signed make sure I've written this right, Trav, because this is right up your alley.
Oh, legal you put stuff. This one in, mate.
Yeah, I know. Hence you've got to do a bloody year. I need you to probably proofread some of my stuff. So they've signed a binding framework agreement with this. So there's privately owned Haoma Mining.
How do you have a binding framework agreement and then you've got a point saying it's not binding?
Well, exactly. So make sure I've got this right. This is allowing them to form a 60-40 JV, so 60 for Calidus, for these Haoma tenements, when all these Haoma tenements are in trucking distance to their Warrawoona project up in near Marble Bar, obviously it's been well publicised, the ramp up issues that Calidus have had. So look, now it's a JV proposal. It's not binding, but it sounds like they've got exclusivity to negotiate to form a binding agreement. But it's not binding. There's no binding agreement yet. They can exclusively try and form this JV to become binding. So, they've got existing stockpiles there that they can, start processing at their Warrawoona project, and they've got a lot of exploration potential because it's privately owned. They don't have any JORC resources attached to them. So,
is the angle here that they need to improve the grade going through?
Yeah.
The mill, yeah.
I would say so. Looked at a lot of the historical production. It was high-grade production in these areas, but privately owned. Look, their reserves 1 gram at Warrawoona. They put through last month was 0.84.
Yeah.
So, and then it was even lower the month before, so they'd be looking for an uplift there, but then any supplementary feed, and you would imagine that I think by the sounds, this Haoma's got a lot of low-grade some stockpiles that aren't viable for them to process, but throw it in the 2.4 million tonne Calidus plant that is running at a proposed reserve grade of 1 gram, I'd say it would make sense.
I wonder what this means in the context. So they have that blue spec project that they bought.
It's the sulphide one.
Yeah, yeah. Super high grade, but I'm pretty sure it's super high arsenic as well, so you need a bit of a processing.
Yeah, so that one, it looks, so they've got I think it's only going to be about 100,000 tonne per annum when that gets going. It's going to be a separate, sulfide plant.
Right,
But that's the stage three of their, it is high grade, but high arsenic.
Yeah, yeah. And that's down the track, right? They can't bring that forward. So this is this seen as a potentially more near-term potential grade up
by the looks, depending if they get the agreement on the 60-40 basis
from binding to binding.
Get the binding framework to go from non-binding agreement to a binding agreement. So hey, I'm sure Reevesy will come on after the quarterly and have a chat.
Love it.
Seen him over in Sydney, said he's keen. So
beautiful.
And look, the general vibe I got, the general message, especially after the interview in Red 5, we know what's happened with Calidus, Pantoro as well. If we can, I reckon for the industry, if they can get like those three companies specifically can pump out a good quarterly and show a bit of a turnaround and they're through the shit a bit, I think that's going to be great for gold sentiment across the board, because until I guess these companies turn it around.
It's an overhang. It's an overhang on the development industry too, right?
Well, it is. Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, you wouldn't want to build a mill at the moment. Look what happened to Calidus, Red 5 and Pantoro.
Yeah.
So that's the that was the vibe, as Dennis Donito said. Yeah. So JD, you still with us, mate?
I sure am, mate. Tuning in. I didn't actually follow the Calidus one too closely. I was a bit more focused on another Goldie with a bit of activity.
Right,
Capricorn.
You're right. Now, don't dish his presentations this time, cause even though it was a compliment. I've heard Clarkey was like, I can't believe they were up me about my Windows 95 presentations. But Capricorn have closed out part of their hedge book.
I'm not sure there's been another company out there that we've been so complimentary of. I'm not sure what you guys think, but...
Patriot?
Yeah, good one. So,
Adriatic, maybe.
Exactly. Adriatic, yeah. Big fans there as well. So, back to what you said, Matty, what this really means is they had 51,000 ounces of hedges, and they were all set sort of between 2,250 and 2,300 Aussie bucks. So, that to sell those lots sort of in 13 and 12,000 ounce lots at the end of each quarter up until the end of June next year. So, what the guys have done is they've used roughly just under 37 million from their cash and bullion, and they had about 120 in cash and bullion at the end of the last quarter to close out these hedges. So they've really just bought the difference in what they were going to deliver. And then they've also bought premiums, which is the amount you have to pay to get an option to sell gold at a price in the future. So what they've bought, that specific option, is a put. And that's the right, but not the obligation, to sell gold in the future at a specific date and time. So, in pretty simply, it's just for the same amount of gold. It's for 51,000 ounces again, but it really protects their downside. So, all up, it sort of cost them 2.55 million is the biggest downside they're going to have in the future. But every 50 bucks, the gold price goes over 2,860 Aussie per ounce, they have the potential to get 2.55 million bucks more. So I think the way to look at it is that the guys at Capricorn Management have the kind of outlook that for this limited downside exposure over the next, say, 12 to 15 months, we could potentially see a higher gold price, and they are, you know, exposed to that higher gold price.
So is their cash position, strong cash position, allowed them, given them the ability to do this, whereas other companies that have, you know, that are pretty strung by their hedge book, like Calidus, like Regis, they don't have the ability to do this?
100%. So Calidus, who we just spoke about, they're not in a position to do this. You have to obviously have the cash balance to be able to do something like this. And I think there might be a few other factors as well as to why they've done it. We're right at the end of the financial year. I don't think that's a complete coincidence that they've done it now, you know, so they might be incurring a bit more of a cost so that they don't have to pay as much tax for the financial year 23 period.
Clarkey's an accountant, isn't he? So he'll be clued on to this stuff, mate.
Probably he does the tax return himself, eh? You know, low cost operation. Imagine how much you'd save in accounting fees a year.
I think my inclination with CMM is more often than not to just back management and the decision they've made. They've proved over the past few years and in their previous incarnations and companies that they've done a pretty good job. And it does seem like a pretty asymmetrical bet, you know. They're limited downside for the potential for that to ride a bit higher. So we'll just sort of have to wait and see. It's not, of course, this is just the hedge book that we're talking about. They've got much more gold that's going to be sold at those higher prices anyway. It's just that portion that was already hedged.
Yeah, it's interesting when you see these puts come out as a different mechanism to provide, you know, gold price hedging. Especially you see it a bit more when the gold price is elevated. I remember back in late 2020 seeing a couple of these pop up. But I kind of like it as well, because when you just look at the typical hedge structure, then you still have this commitment to deliver the ounces, and sometimes you might run into a bit of a production obstacle, and it makes delivery challenging depending on what proportion of your production profile it is. But the put gives you a bit more of a bit more flexibility with whatever your production is, but still gives you the hedging dynamic from a gold price perspective.
Yeah, agreed. You do see it more in these sort of heightened gold price environments. And then obviously when the gold price comes off, companies aren't quite as keen to lock that in.
Right. You boys want to touch on Galena? They give a little monthly update or no?
Yeah, I'm keen, mate. They put out a pretty brief monthly update today as they continue to ramp up. I was a bit disappointed with it, Maddie, not because of the words in it, but more just the lack of words in a way. We got two paragraphs on how things are going. There's a photo of a ship. There's a photo of a remote control facility above ground. Like, I imagine if I was a Galena shareholder, I'd be wanting a bit more color and specifics with how things are going, especially.
Do you think they should have put anything out if this is the case?
Yeah.
Well, they should have put something a bit more detail.
More detail. More addressing. Like, I think shareholders were surprised when they had to raise money during ramp up. They didn't. I mean, it was great to have TJ come on and explain that. We probably should have come at it from a different position, right? Yep. I'd be wanting to learn as much about that part as possible.
100%. We know just from that discussion how tough the next 12 months is for the company. And I think shareholders and the market, if they have to wait every 3 months to get some sort of an update, they're gonna get a bit angsty. So it's the right thing for the company to do to keep shareholders updated with everything that's going on.
Yeah. I mean, the real tell is just going to be what's their cash balance looking like at the month end. And hopefully we get a bit more specifics when we get their quarterly out next month.
God, there's this upcoming quarterlies. I know every quarterly season's got a different theme, but cash balance and debt would be a big one for this. Let's say Galena, Red 5, Calidus, who else? Pantoro.
Yep.
Who else? I guess which other ones are you looking forward to?
It's also like even more important perhaps at the explorer and developer end, because they're the ones that don't have any cash to fall on. So obviously if you're producing, you want to be cash flow positive as well, but everyone's going to be having their eyes peeled for what these explorers and developers are coming out with and thinking, oh, how long's it going to be till they have to raise?
Yeah.
Global Lithium, Trav, I reckon you'd be all over this one. It's got your feel about it.
It's an interesting one. So Global Lithium, they've taken a 10% stake in Kairos. Via a $4 million placement at a 5.9% premium. It's also paired with a capital raising. There's about a $6 million of other money coming into the mix as well. And that sort of $10 million is going to go into the ground. Kairos, they have a bit of a gold project not too far from Tigray, but they've also got what they call, some tenure and a bit of a lithium play that's not too far from Global Lithium's Manna project. So looks to me like Global Lithium are keen to bolster up the broader regional play of the economics of their Manna project with what they see as something prospective nearby. So yeah, interesting one. We'll keep our eyes peeled on it.
Right, neurology time. Oh, I love these ones. Encounter. So they're ENR, aren't they?
It's just a trading hold, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, but you never know. So ENR, I think, stands for extremely near. So WA1. So they've entered a trading hold pending announcement of material exploration results at West Arunta, which is obviously the ground neighbouring WA1. They had a run with WA1.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I mean.
But we don't know yet.
We don't know yet. But I think we should be excited and interested, because like imagine if they do have something that's bloody, pretty important there. They might hit the IOCG that WA1 were looking for.
Yeah, not bad,
but
Trav.
It's kind of, I hope they have positive results. I've got no horse in the race. We had Bogan Geologist on saying that he doesn't think it's likely that they'll have something. But if they do, like imagine just the rush of activity and excitement there will be towards a new province in WA. Like that'll just be, I think it'll just be a good thing for WA exploration. So
I think, as Bogan said, the chance of them hitting another rich niobium is very small considering the percentages across
carbonatites.
But we don't know.
Yeah, well, as it is, WA1, they have two themselves, right? They had the initial P4 prospect plus Looney, so they have two. So I don't know. And they model it as if a carbonatite ends at the border of the tenement encounter, model it as if it goes over the top. But yeah, let's just see what happens. Let's hope for a good news story here.
What's I'm just Googling in advance. What's IOCG stand for again?
Iron ore, copper, iron oxide. Gold. Oh, iron oxide, sorry. Thanks, JD.
Iron oxide, copper, gold. Copper deposits. Gold. Iron oxide, copper, gold. They're usually big suckers.
They can be, yeah. And I think they're often deep. Yeah. I don't know heaps, mate. I'm not a geo, but yeah.
There you go. Last one before we get into the deep dive. Geez, not crisp today, JD. Sorry, mate. A lot of info for a Monday. Strickland sell their Melrose project to Northern Star for $61 million.
Near Jundee, isn't it, Matty?
40 k's east. Yeah, 40 k's east of Jundee. And so you look at it first up, 346,000 ounces in resource for $41 million cash and 1.5 million Northern Star shares. So... Mm-hmm. 346,000 ounces for $61 million. You're like, is that good? Is that bad?
Yeah.
$176 an ounce.
Yeah.
Musgrave's offer from Westgold was $190 an ounce.
There you go.
It's actually a bit cheaper than that offer.
Yeah. Probably maybe less advanced, right? Because they had a PFS and all that, but yeah.
Yeah. So it's still pretty high, I guess. Yeah. So they obviously see a lot of exploration potential to feed that Jundee mill. So.
Yeah, well, it's more to the point of that same theme is, you know, who's really setting the price for these undeveloped ounces right now? It's the corporates engaged in M&A, not the equity markets. It's interesting to – I'm curious why they didn't acquire the company instead of the asset. You avoid the stamp duty, shareholders, the beneficiary they get, you know, it's a more tax efficient outcome for them. And but this was an interesting one because Strickland get the cash and they've got a plan in their announcement to drill out their other projects and all that sort of stuff. Now if I was a Strickland shareholder,
Northern Star might think they they'd rather someone else spend the money on to explore it.
Well,
Strickland bought the project for $10 million in 2021, drilled for 11 months at a cost of $16 million, and now they're selling it for $61 million. So that's a $35 million profit just on drilling some holes. So pretty well done there.
They should give the cash to shareholders so they get the benefit of it.
Yeah. There was another bit in that announcement about the new solar and wind energy infrastructure going out to Jundee.
Yeah.
A bit of word on the decline that come from, they snagged that from someone else that was going to need it.
Oh, cool.
Did you know about, did I tell you that little word on the decline?
I have heard that one. Very interesting.
It's to do with someone that changed a power contract.
Bit of bad blood,
that's a
blood,
juicy
mate.
One, Matty.
Bit of word on the decline. Anyway, we won't go into that. Hit us up on the Money Miners chat. Jeez, that isn't that going off far out. That's become bloody very intense, the Money Miners Hoodaroo chat.
We got 220-odd people in the Facebook group and I think almost 200 of them in that chat.
In the chat.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Let's get into it. Parenti to acquire DDH1 Mining Services. So, pardon me. I'll just go over who's who in the zoo first, lads, for people that don't know. So
this is your, mate, you're across this space more than we are.
Yeah.
I did work for
Barminco for a bit. Yeah. No, I'm sure they miss me. So Parenti, they're the parent group of, so Barminco, everyone know them as one of the big underground mining contractors in Australia and across the world. So, and they've got AUMS as well, African Underground Mining Services, AMS, African Mining Service. So that's their mining division. Then they've also got Ausdrill, which was originally founded by Ronnie Sayers, may he rest in peace. So that's they started out as big exploration drilling, but then they also do open pit mining services, drill and blast and all that. I think they're at the Super Pit, they're at Mungari, they're all over the shop, NBTP, which is heavy equipment maintenance and refurb. So that's Parenti. They're a big, they
big behemoth.
Pretty much consolidated all those all those contractors together. Then you've got DDH1. So they're the biggest exploration drilling company in Australia. So they were predominantly surface exploration, before this, but now they've taken the big market share of underground exploration because they bought Swick last year. So Swick is one of the biggest underground diamond drilling exploration contractors. So they bought them in 2022. So Swick have been bought by DDH1. Now DDH1 are getting bought again. And then the Swick founders, I think Kent Swick, was given DDH1 scrip for the purchase, and he's getting bought out again. So he is absolutely flying. So, boys, let's get into what the deal is. What's the premium? How's it work? And why is... I want to ask this question in advance. The risk of consolidating a very low margin industry of mining services, the bigger you go, is that more risk to a business because you're on such lower margins if shit goes sour in the industry? So, right, get into it. Take it away,
we'll
boys.
We'll get into it. All right, let's just hit the high notes to start with. So 17% premium, this is a cash and scrip deal. So you'll see in all the presentations that it's sort of implied a $1.01 DDH1 share price, and then you sort of pull it up and realize, oh, they're trading at like 92 odd cents. So that sort of relates to so much of the deal being in Perenti scrip. So the Perenti price is down off almost 10%, which means that the DDH share price that you see is, you know, it's trading in line with the offer at roughly 92 odd cents. It kind of values DDH1 at $410 million. Rather, and they sort of paraded that the combined group is $1.3 billion. So it looked kind of open and shut. You mentioned Kent Swick there, Matty. So the board were pro the deal. They've already accepted it, and they hold 13% of DDH1. Now, that's got largely to do with Swick and obviously the rest of them having such a large shareholding. Now, they've also got in touch with 25% of the DDH1 shareholders.
Because those DDH1 shareholders, they've got some private equity still in there, right? Oaktree, from memory?
Absolutely. So we'll touch on Oaktree in a sec as well, but that sort of combines to roughly 38% of the registry at DDH being, being pro this deal, obviously in the absence of a better one coming about. So it's done via a scheme of arrangement, and it'll wrap up in October if it all goes forward without a hiccup. Now, Trev, you mentioned Oaktree there. There was a line in the transaction overview. Perenti has separately entered into a call option deed with Oaktree, so that's the investor, providing Perenti with the ability to acquire just under 20% of DDH1 shares from Oaktree upon DDH1 receiving a competing proposal. So that's something we've seen before. You flagged that we'd seen it with Wesfarmers and API Pharma not that long ago, and it's a pretty kind of tidy strategy to prevent a sort of interloper or someone else coming in and ruining your deal.
So can you dumb this down for us underground miners, this strategy?
Yeah. So
and
imagine
why don't other people use it?
Maddie, think of the essential deal with MinRes that we spoke about.
Yep.
That the outcome would be the same. It would provide Perenti with a sort of blocking stake. So if someone were to come in, they'd be like, oh, shit, we can't actually wrap up the deal.
Mm.
So that's the idea about why you do it. The mechanics of like how you do it, you need obviously a shareholder on board who's willing to be on the other side of that transaction.
Okay, so that's the key. You got to become chummy with a shareholder existing and get them to agree to this option without you actually buying the shares. You've got
an option to buy it at whatever that new price
is. Okay, I get you now. So that's the key thing, is finding, having a relationship on the other side.
Yeah, it deters an interloper before they enter the arena.
Yeah, very good. I love M&A. Yeah. Shit, I'm learning a lot about this bloody mining podcast.
Yeah, it's really
what
cool.
A career.
Yeah.
I love
Matty,
it, boys.
Here is what M&A is all about, and Trav is probably a bit better at this than I am, but is this deal value accretive? So that is always the terminology you're going to hear when M&A comes about.
They're and accretive, what's accretive mean? It's going to, is it?
Are you buying the company, the target, at a lower multiple than you trade at? Therefore, whatever their earnings are, you know, you chuck it in at your multiple, accretive.
So will the earnings per share of the combined business be greater after the transaction? So Perenti claims in their presentation that they'll have a 30% increase in FY23 EBITDA and 100% increase in FY24 EBITDA. Now, you have to remember, you know, this isn't coming for free. They're giving away roughly 30% of the business. They also say that EBITDA, their margin is going to improve to 10%. So that kind of touches on what you mentioned at the top of the show, that they're not sexy businesses, you know, they're not super high margin businesses by any stretch of the imagination.
What, 1-4% sometimes?
Yeah. Especially when you look at through COVID, they got a real crunch in those margins. There's another aspect which makes the deal look quite good. It brings the overall exposure of Perenti more Aussie domiciled. So obviously you touched on African Underground and African Mining Services. Perenti, I think the number I saw has like a 28% exposure to West Africa. So the combined entity here will have a greater exposure to Australia. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see a company like NRW, so stock ticker NWH, trade at a better multiple, because they don't have that jurisdiction risk that Perenti has.
But I think that's where they make a lot of their money. Like, my understanding is that the underground mining contractors anyway, a lot of their, they could break even or lose money in Australia, but it all gets uplifted from what they earn over in Africa. All the offshore companies.
It's just like the mining companies as well, in the sense, you know, like the West African Resources, higher risk, higher reward. Yeah. So there's other aspects as well, like leverage. DDH1 is a way less levered company. The debt on the books at Perenti is almost equivalent to the market cap. And then you, of course, have like listing and tax synergies, which they'll promote to the media and the public as well.
Corporate synergies, and mate. You only need one CEO, CFO.
That's it. You only have to do one sort of round of listing fees and all that.
Yeah.
And an interesting point which they touched on, the younger fleet that DDH1 has. So to me, that straight away stands out as a benefit, because if you have a younger fleet, you have less maintenance cost, you have less CapEx in the future because you have to buy less rigs and all that. So that sort of equates to, if it works out well, more earnings.
Just on your comment about valuation, JD, I remember DDH, they didn't IPO all that long ago. And when they IPO'd, they IPO'd at $1.10 per share. I think that was the back end of 2021, or maybe it was mid-2021. It was the start of 2021. So when that happened, $1.10 per share, the EV to EBITDA ratio that they were IPOing at was 5.3 times. Now, like, think of that period of time, right? The start of 2021. You just had all of the exploration companies had raised a bunch of money and were going to start drilling. So it was pretty clear that you had a huge workbook of drilling, and there was probably even not enough rigs to go around. Remember, it was so hard to get rigs, and assays were taking so long to come back. So there was just so much.
And the salary of drillers was going through the roof as well, wasn't
it? Yeah, totally. So these, like DDH, it IPO'd at 5.3 times EBITDA. They acquired Swick for 3.9 times EBITDA. Now, this deal was done at 3.5 times EBITDA on industrials analyst Ian Christie's numbers. So when you go from 5.3 times down to 3.5 times in the space of 2.5 years, I think that shows a bit in the sense of how this business is valued throughout the cycle, right? When you can have higher margins because there's not enough rigs to go around, to now, a few years later, you look ahead, what's that workbook look like? Well, it looks like there's probably more rigs than there is work to go around now. So
I'd be interested to see the overhang from COVID for these mining services companies as well. Like, they had to pay all their workers, like, when they were off for COVID leave and like quarantining, and the overhang, I reckon, and the debt that they would, well, you mentioned Perenti's debt, there would have to be a huge overhang still from COVID, plus the high wages they had to pay as well to keep them. So it was a bit of a double-edged sword.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's worth sort of digging into, like, are these synergies real, and can they actually be achieved? Obviously, everyone, when a deal comes about, is going to promote it. And I obviously we touched on a few points there, but I think in most cases they are quite straightforward. The listing fees and the tax ones, they're, you know, pretty check and check. The jurisdiction one makes sense to me. So I think a lot of them are quite achievable. The we mentioned the leverage, but Parenti has a net debt ratio that they run at, and they corporately have managed that pretty well. They've done a good job at that, but I don't think it hurts to take over a company with slightly less debt than themselves. So looking into assessing the overall takeover and thinking, you know, is this deal accretive that we touched on? We have all of those things. Plus, you've also got the opportunities of enhanced scale and the multiple that these guys trade at. If they're a bigger company, potentially lower costs of capital. And there's another interesting angle, which the company sort of touches on. They want to be the go-to company if institutional investors are going to come to mining services. So mining services has been a sector that's been abandoned by a lot of institutional investors for a long time. So when the companies are sort of forecasting that these institutional investors will come back to the space, they want to be the one name that the guys come in and say, yep, we're going to just put our money toward you to get exposure to the overall sector.
To your point, JD, on are those synergies, you know, like real or not, I put a phone call out to someone who runs a mining services company today to see, you know, what he thought of the rationale. And what he said is, look, this deal, it might just cement Parenti in as the preferred miner for the occasional, you know, job that DDH would have otherwise won from a drilling perspective. You know, like hypothetically, imagine it was DDH who were doing the drilling for Delta, then it positions, you know, Parenti's wider business in the best possible position to do the mining there. I think it's Top Drill that have the actual contract for Delta, but as a scenario there, that's kind of one way you could realise synergies. The words he used was they become the preferred, you know, mining services company from cradle to graveyard. So.
But I'm interested to know if that actually plays or not, because they still, even though Parenti own them all, it's still, they'll still have a DDH1 shirt on. You'll still deal with, it's still all divided up into subsidiaries. Like it's still Bar Minco doing the underground mining in Australia. It's still Swick doing the underground diamond drilling. They're just owned by DDH1. It's like it's the only synergies are up really, really high.
Yes.
Unless they rebranded to the whole thing, which they're not going to. No. I'm not sure if the synergies will apply or not. And besides the real up top corporate costs, but then the bigger you get, the more corporate activity you need to run it. So I'm not sure. What do you reckon, JD?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like the other obvious aspect of like M&A is does it sort of make strategic sense? And a lot of those points we kind of touched on, to your point, are sort of corporate related, aren't they? They're not at that sort of lower level. But when I sort of weigh up the benefits for Parenti versus like the benefits for DDH and together, does it make a sense? You know, for Parenti, lessens leverage, you know, lessens exposure to Africa. They also, across all those brands that you named, they get exposure to a bigger sort of commodity mix. So previously there was a lot more focus on gold. Now they're across the spectrum a bit more. They get that sort of increased prominence of scale, you know, bigger market cap than NRW and so on. Potentially in the future, they'll get the benefits of a cheaper cost of capital because they're not so focused on West Africa. They're a bigger sort of organization. And like I sort of touched on before, they're more attractive to institutional investors. So they look like the key parts of the deal to me.
Is there benefits for taxation and like depreciation and things like that when you've got multiple subsidiaries you can flick shit around to?
There probably is a little bit there. But the other thing I think, like just from a rationale perspective we haven't touched on, is think of the shareholder dynamics at DDH. So you got, you know, I think like 20% to Oaktree there. Oaktree, you're going to much prefer a percentage of a wider Parenti, far more liquid stock.
A bigger liquid name.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Then so they can sell out easier when they need to.
100%.
Yeah. Here's a play. This would make sense if they buy mines as well.
Mm. Wow, that's a bit left field. That's
but you think it's an organisation
business.
Yeah, I know, but if they went into buying mines as well and did a full service from exploration drilling all the way to mining and production, that'd make a lot of sense then, and that's where a lot of profit. You're essentially creating your own massive mining services company to
the trend
run your
for vertical
own
integration, right now,
run your own mine. So,
yeah. I like it, Matty.
Geez, you know, I always come up with a left field. Oh, I come up with a good left field one at the Gold Series one.
Did
I posed a question. I pretty much hinted that two companies should merge together, because they're both their closest mills were owned by the same major. Ooh. I'm like, wouldn't you merge together and then make yourself more appealing as a unit?
I like it, mate.
Mate, don't worry. One of these will come true one day.
I reckon they all will. And then we'll make a montage of your left field calls that come true.
Right. Who's getting a better deal, boys? Parenti or DDH1?
DDH getting a premium. Parenti share price trading down right now.
Pretty DDH. Self-explanatory.
Yeah.
What about Parenti in terms of long-term growth? But then comes the risk.
They'll have a view on. Yeah, they will have a view on that. Hopefully, I'm sure that they've done their DD. I mean, it's an agreed scheme. They've done their DD. They like what they see. Internally, it stacks up. The market might take a while to see that.
Right.
Agreed. There's one more thing I wanted to touch on. Trav, you touched on Ian Christie, the industrial analyst at Argonauts Research earlier. And just pulling up some numbers from end of FY23, Parenti is trading at 0.56 times their net assets. So I think that just speaks to how unloved mining services is, and it just goes to show it's a pretty tough business.
Does that include their debt? Margins. Net assets includes their debt?
So that's their assets taking off all their liabilities.
Yep.
Gives you net assets. So the market cap is 0.56 times their net assets.
Is there any like goodwill? Because they've done a lot of acquisitions, right?
I'd have to dig into how much goodwill. Hang on.
And does that lock the assets, because it's a lot of plant and equipment, does it take into account how old it is and how much it's depreciated?
There is a chunky amount of intangibles and stuff in there too.
Okay. I'd be curious to see their NTA. Their tangible assets. Yeah. Because they.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. But you've also obviously got the super low margins that we touched on, like that, a goal of reaching 10% EBIT margin. So, yeah, it just speaks to this not being a super profitable space.
Totally.
And like you touched on, Matty, high risk.
Beauty, great research, lads. As always, great to have the gang back. Not physically. Wait till JD's. When are you back, JD? Wednesday.
Thursday.
Wednesday night, mate.
Thursday night.
In the flesh.
Oh, we should do like a midnight madness one week. Get some pharmaceutical assistance and stay up and do a midnight special. That'd be the bloody go. Now we're talking. Righto, Money Miners. Come join the Hooteroo chat. I want to ask as well, if you're having dramas, because I saw someone using an iPhone and they were going on there and they couldn't get access to the Hooteroo chat from the group.
Yeah, that's on the cards to fix, lads. We're getting to that one.
Have you had that problem?
Yeah, had that myself as well.
Is it on I think it might be a model of the iPhone, I've got a feeling. If anyone else has that drama.
No, we'll get there. It's actually the computer for me.
Oh, yeah, the computer does it.
Yeah, I saw someone's phone. It was actually Mr. Brightstar. Couldn't get on the chat. So if anyone has dramas, give us a message somewhere. We've got messages everywhere. And come join the Money Miners Facebook group and the Hooteroo chat. Link's in the show notes. Any other messages, boys?
And we got a weekly newsletter coming up.
Oh, JD. JD, we're ticking off one thing at a time. Jeez, we've even got bloody potential sponsorship opportunities. Oh, God, maybe we'll throw one out. We might survive.
Don't be sure.
Right up. Hooteroo, everyone. Cheers, Money Miners. Great to be back.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.